We all know correlation is not causality, but if you talk about recession enough, do you get a recession? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 21st of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to start way big picture today. A little bit of Federal Reserve, a little bit of the Congressional Budget Office, a quick pass by the R word, and then you, the source of all hope in this economy, you, the American consumer. Which sounds like an exaggeration, actually, that bit about you being the source of all hope, but really, it's mostly not, as you will see. All right, so with the Fed, we begin in the observation that the central bank released the minutes of its most recent meeting this morning. That'd be the meeting back last month when it cut interest rates for the first time in a decade. Just one quick point about this, and then a caveat. The point is this. It's clear from the minutes that there are some divisions within the Federal Open Market Committee about what to do with this economy. Some people wanted a bigger cut in interest rates. Some people wanted none. Jay Powell, the chairman, pretty much split the difference with that quarter point, as you remember. Here, though, is the caveat. Powell is giving a big, big speech on Friday at a Fed meeting out in Wyoming. Tune in, as they say, for the tea leaf reading on that one. We'll have it for you. All right, the Congressional Budget Office, as promised, the CBO was out with one of its regular economic forecasts today. The news was not great. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The CBO said that the government is doing worse in terms of its finances, even worse than we had expected, meaning the deficits are climbing, in essence, about $1 trillion of deficits to be expected each year in the coming decade.
$1 trillion a year for the next decade. The Trump tax cuts increase government spending. You know the reasons. It matters because,
as deficits are over $1 trillion, what happens when the government really needs to stimulate the economy when there's an economic downturn? And you're running out of room the higher and higher those debts go.
Of course, there's always the Fed, but we know what the president thinks about the Fed, right? So let's talk about a downturn. The not great economic signs are getting a lot of attention on this program and pretty much on every other outlet that covers the economy because it's the job. Global growth is down, business confidence down as well. There's a trade war you might have heard of, that inverted yield curve as well, which happened again today, by the way. On the other hand, President Trump and his advisors are saying everything's fine, better than fine, actually, strongest economy ever, but that all the coverage is going to spook consumers and push us into a recession. So can that happen? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports now on the power of negative thinking.
There's this concept in psychology called the availability heuristic. I know, sorry, jargon. But it has to do with how suggestible people are. Kelly Lanier is a behavioral economist at Emory University.
For example, if you've just watched the movie Jaws, then you might be less likely to go swimming in the ocean than someone who has not seen the movie or has not seen it in several years.
Granted, we're talking about the economy and actual economic indicators, not a fictional movie. But she says the point is, the more we hear about something, the more we're going to think about it.
So if recessions are consistently, or a talk of recessions is consistently in the news, then individuals can't help but be thinking of that.
Especially when they're making spending decisions. Now for the caveats. First, we can't predict what consumers are going to do with negative news about the economy.
You'd have, you know, one camp that will squirrel away money for a rainy day, and then you have others that would choose to spend it all now.
Second caveat, consumers think about a lot of things when they're deciding whether to buy stuff, like their personal finances. Bart Van Ark is chief economist at the Conference Board.
You know, what do they have in their bank account, and what do they get in terms of their payroll every month?
Van Ark also points out that while negative economic news could hurt consumer spending, the news right now isn't all negative.
At one moment, they hear news about wage increases and a strong labor market. And at other times, they hear news about the trade disputes and the markets coming down.
So if anything, consumers are probably a little confused. We get it. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Here is where you get to chime in. Go to marketplace.org. Let us know what you think when you hear me and everybody else use that R word. And speaking of you, by the way, the stuff buying American public, as we've been reporting, the American economy is still in decent shape, in no small part because consumer confidence and spending is still doing pretty well. To that end, mega retailer Target reported higher quarterly sales and profits this morning, buoyed, no doubt, by us. But as Marketplace's Andy Eula reports, Target's recent run is also very much about Target.
At the end of February 2017, Target reported declining sales and profits for the holiday season just passed, and the company issued a gloomy outlook. CEO Brian Cornell told investors he was going to spend billions of dollars to help lower prices and also remodel hundreds of stores. Investors killed Target's stock.
If you think about where retail's going today, investing in stores doesn't seem like the right move.
That's Sonia Lipinski. She covers retail at Alex Partners. She says in the age of Amazon, it all felt like a reach, but Target was playing the long game.
People are still going to stores. They're just, their expectations for those stores are really different.
She says Target's made its stores more appealing to shoppers. Neil Saunders is retail analyst at Global Data. He says Target also chose wisely in pushing proprietary brands like Market Pantry and Made by Design, where the margins are higher.
If you want their brand of clothing or their brand of home essentials or home products, you have to go to Target to get them. So that differentiation has really helped.
But Target didn't forget about Amazon. The company invested in speeding delivery of website orders and easy store pickups. Bob Phibbs runs the Retail Doctor consultancy.
You know, when you look at brands that aren't able to do this, JCPenney, Macy's, they haven't had this consistent laser focus on knowing exactly what they should be doing without veering from that.
He says Target has made the right investment choices recently, and it's going to need to do more of that if it wants to keep winning in a rapidly changing retail environment. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday. All good, thanks. You? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You ever put on one of those virtual reality headsets? Probably not, right? They still haven't, a handful of years after the first consumer models came out. They still haven't really caught on, much less let us retreat into escapist fantasy worlds or virtual relationships. Oculus Quest and the like are still pretty expensive, and there's really not that much content for them anyway. But even though home use hasn't quite gone mainstream, the VR industry is starting to focus on businesses, employee training in particular. From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Inside an unremarkable office park in the L.A. area, virtual reality startup Tailspin is creating new worlds, which are pretty unremarkable themselves. No fantasy landscapes or gunslinging here. Tailspin's latest virtual reality training puts users behind a boring old desk in a nondescript office. The task? Call in a virtual employee named Barry and, as gingerly as possible, let him go.
How many times has Barry been fired?
Oh my gosh, thousands. Thousands.
The idea is to work on communication skills in an emotionally charged situation most people don't encounter every day. Tailspin CEO Kyle Jackson helped me strap on a headset so I could give it a try.
You're basically going to speak what you see on screen there.
Gotcha.
I'm behind a desk in an office with a water cooler, post-it notes, and the hum of phone calls in the background. Hi, Barry. Come on in. Barry sits across from me, a middle-aged man with graying hair and wrinkles etched into his face. I wouldn't mistake him for a real human, but yet, when he speaks...
How are you? You look great. New hairstyle, right?
It's kind of hard not to feel sorry for the guy, knowing what I'm about to do.
Thank you. I feel terrible about this, but I have some bad news.
The program gives you some options for what you should say to Barry, the objective being to get through the firing process without too many hard feelings. It didn't work.
Who do you think you are? What are you, 30 years old? I've been doing this for 30 years, damn it!
I failed.
Right. So I think you should try again.
Okay, let's try again.
Virtual reality training like this is a growing business. A report from tech industry advisory firm ABI Research predicts the market for workplace VR will explode from just a couple $100 million last year to more than $6 billion by 2022. Walmart has been using virtual reality training to prepare store employees for Black Friday the last couple years and to assess workers for possible management roles. At the Farmers Insurance headquarters in Los Angeles, Jessica DeCanio showed me the VR program that trains hundreds of claims adjusters.
This module here is giving the trainee an opportunity to go through an entire simulation of when they go into a customer's home.
It lets them navigate a home looking for damage. In this simulation, a moldy, disgusting toilet.
One thing that we were most excited about, how realistic the images are.
It looks like bad damage.
That is some bad water coming out of that toilet.
Trainees have to assess the damage and talk to customers.
It increases their confidence. And the more confident our claims reps are, the better customer experience that they can provide.
But when you get past the wow factor, is virtual reality really any more effective than, say, watching a PowerPoint or role-playing with colleagues? Psychologist Skip Rizzo at the University of Southern California thinks it is.
There's nothing magic about it. It's really just a tool, but a very emotionally evocative tool.
Rizzo has studied therapeutic applications of VR for treating soldiers with PTSD and patients with severe phobias. He says the immersive nature of the technology not only grabs people's attention, it affects their brains.
At some level, people know that they're not really in this place. But the area that drives emotion, the fight or flight area of the brain, that area just responds to the perception.
Back at Tailspin, Barry is still having a bad day, but on my second try, I found the right thing to say.
Take the time to process this. I'll go over the next steps when you're ready.
Look, I appreciate the opportunity. It was a pleasure working with you.
That seems like it went much better.
Success!
Now, if only we could find him a new job. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Random, interesting economic fact of this Wednesday, of which I was not aware until today. There's a statute of limitations of sorts on a lot of the consumer debt that's out there. It's different in different states, and it depends on the kind of debt we're talking about, credit card versus, say, doctor's bills. But after that statute runs, I mean, you still owe the money, but debt collection agencies are really limited in what they can do to get you to pay, which has led those collection agencies to get creative. Renee Merle covers business for The Washington Post, including this slice of the debt collection economy. Renee, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do me a favor and tell me, first of all, what kind of debt we're talking about here?
We're mostly talking about consumer debt, credit cards, auto loans, that sort of thing.
Okay. And so to the point of this article, we are talking now, obviously, about debt that is old. It has been passed from the original owner of the debt to collection agencies. And what you have discovered and reported on in this piece is that there are ways that those collection agencies are using to reinvigorate, shall we say, this old and expired debt.
Exactly. So there's a statute of limitations, and after that time, debt collectors can no longer sue you to recover that debt. But there's a loophole. And if you make a payment, no matter how small, a penny, a dollar, that resets the statute of limitations. And so they're no longer restricted from suing you.
Okay, so tell me the story of this woman in the piece. I think it was a 19-cent payment that got garnished from wages, and then that was used. Give me her story.
Exactly. So this is an Oklahoma woman who had old debt. She had gone through a divorce and a bankruptcy, and she had this old Target credit card bill, and she had tried to pay it but couldn't. She got a notice in the mail that they were trying to sue her. And what they were citing as their last payment was 19 cents that they had garnished from her checking account. If you had gone back to the last purposeful payment that right. she had made, the debt would have been too old to collect. But since they were citing the 19 cents, they said they were still legally able to sue her for that bill.
Right. So talk to me now about the current state of affairs, because we have a Federal Fair Lending Act that is something like 40 years old. You say in this piece there are different laws depending on the state and the kind of bill it is. There is an entire federal bureaucracy called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau involved in this. What is the current state of play on debt like this that is old and attempting to be collected?
Well, the first thing you need to realize that consumer debt is at an all-time high. It just reached $4 trillion. And so while the economy is still good and people are still generally keeping up with their bills, if there's ever a recession, this becomes a more pressing issue. At the same time, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, is issuing this real first update in 40 years to debt collection rules. And consumer advocates are actually really concerned that the update that they're proposing won't help consumers. consumers and stopping debt collectors from trying to trick you into, you know, reviving this old debt.
Say more about that tricking thing, because consumers, while in theory responsible for their actions, are sometimes naive, and debt collectors can be creative.
Well, I've heard of cases where the debt collector calls and says, look, I'll stop calling if you just pay me $25. And the consumer doesn't realize if they pay that $25, that allows the debt collector to sue them. And so they're actually, you know, allowing the debt collector to kind of trick the consumer into reviving this debt that they couldn't go after them for legally otherwise.
We should point out here, actually, that this is all legal, right? I mean, there are loopholes that these agencies are taking advantage of. They've got good lawyers who figure this stuff out.
Debt collectors say, look, we're following the law. Right. And they admit the law is complicated. The problem is for consumers, it's even more complicated. I've been covering these issues for quite a while. I had no idea there was a statute of limitations on, you know, my right. cell phone bill. And so it creates an unequal playing field against the debt collector.
And now they have it because they've listened to this and read your piece. Renee Merle at The Washington Post, where she covers business. Renee, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I haven't taken a receipt from an ATM in 2 years because it's like too painful.
When the money is there, but you just don't want to think about it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 240 today, 0.9%, 26,202 for the blue chips. NASDAQ picked up 71 points, also 0.9%, 8,020. S&P 500 added 23 points, 0.8%, 29.24. Today was much better than yesterday for retailers, especially for Target. As Andy Euler was telling us, shares in Target closed up 22.0%. Home improvement retailer Lowe's beat quarterly profit estimates and reported it's gaining ground on its rival Home Depot. Shares in Lowe's added 10%. Today, Urban Outfitters beat estimates as well. Shares closed up 6.9%. Spider-Man might, and you got to stress might here, not be appearing in any more Disney films as the studio tussles with Sony over the web-slinger's on-screen time in the Marvel Universe. Shares in Disney closed up 0.4%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Right near the top of the list are the most challenging technology problems companies are trying to figure out right now. And these are consumer-oriented technology problems. I should be clear about that. They're trying to figure out self-driving cars. GM, Tesla, Waymo from Google parent company, Alphabet, and countless startups as well are trying to cut expensive human drivers out of the loop and, as part of the package, run fleets of revenue-generating robo-taxis as well. And here is why I mention all that. Today, Waymo, one of the leaders in the self-driving race, gave away a hefty set of self-driving data for free, which is surprising because the data is really valuable and perhaps it's the key to winning as well. Marketplace's Jack Stewart explains what's going on.
Waymo is running a passenger-carrying pilot program in Phoenix, Arizona. 1,000 residents there can summon a car using an app and pay for a ride under computer control. Marketplace rode with passenger Damian Nichols earlier this year.
You know, I had to do a double take because you're like, is somebody really touching those pedals? But they're not.
While they cruise around, Waymo's robo minivans use their scanners and cameras to collect information. The company says it's covered 10 million miles in 25 cities in autonomous mode. It's sharing a small part of that data. Johnny Luz from Waymo.
What we're making available today is what we believe to be one of the largest type of data sets around for self-driving.
The company's releasing 1,000 20-second segments. They look like videos with rainbow-coloured lines and boxes marking pedestrians and other vehicles. For researchers, getting hold of that real-world data is crucial for developing and testing self-driving systems, says Howard Abbey at SBD Automotive. It's where they find hard-to-simulate edge cases, like people pushing strollers or chasing animals, that are difficult for computers to recognize.
That's something that the researchers wouldn't have unless companies like Waymo capture these.
Aptiv, Argo AI, and Lyft have also shared datasets. The companies get the benefit of smart researchers working on some of these really tough problems, and they also make sure the next batch of computer scientists that they're going to want to recruit are already trained on their style of data. And there are plenty of self-driving situations still to crack, says Navigant Research's Sam Abu Al-Samad.
The farther along they get in developing automated driving technology, the more they realize how far they are still from the end point.
So in this case, sharing some data could help drive the whole field towards the finish line. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Getting a bunch of money, like a bunch of money, out of the blue sounds like a good thing, right? Maybe something you've daydreamed about. Maybe not like this, though. Marketplace's Peter Ballin and Rosen. He's a producer for our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, has this story of how money can complicate somebody's grief.
When my friend Dean Antonio's dad died 2 years ago, one of the first people to reach out was the HR rep at his dad's company. She said Dean was going to get a check with his dad's last paycheck, bonuses his dad was due, and his dad's life insurance policy.
It felt horrible to even have to think about money at that point. And it felt like dirty to know that I was getting money because he died.
Dean was 25 at the time and a full-time tutor with student loans, so not exactly flush with cash. But this was not the payday he expected. Dean and his dad were super close. They lived in different cities but talked almost every day. And now he was getting a check after his death.
Direct deposited into my bank account.
How much money?
About $400,000. It's a lot of money, and, you know, I don't want any of it.
And so ever since he got that money, Dean's gone out of his way to avoid it.
I haven't taken a receipt from an ATM in 2 years because it's like too painful to see the number up on the screen or on the piece of paper.
What exactly is it reminding you of?
That I don't have my dad anymore. That I got money because I don't have my dad anymore. That I have to use this money wisely because it's one of the last things I have from him. Yeah, and that's a lot to pop up like at the ATM in a bar, right? Like on a Saturday night.
I'm sure.
Just to be like, oh, let me get some more money for my drinks. And my dad's dead.
Dean knows his dad would want him to use the money to buy a new instrument or go on a trip or pay off his student loans. But he feels too guilty about having it to spend the money on basically anything.
Our brains can be a little bit tricky when it comes to money.
That's Amanda Clayman. She's a financial therapist in Los Angeles, and she helps clients work through their feelings about money, including people conflicted over inheritances. Clayman says when we're emotionally overwhelmed, our executive functioning, like the way we plan for the future and do basic math, that basically goes offline.
When we hold on to that money because we're afraid to use it, it's probably because we're still thinking of it as our loved one's money.
Oh, interesting. So I shouldn't be thinking about this as, oh, this was my dad's money. I need to start thinking about this as this is my money.
Exactly. And money needs to be put to use. It needs to be put to work.
And the first step, maybe the hardest, is to just get used to having that money. Right now, my friend Dean says the money just doesn't feel like it's his.
Like, do you see this as a gift that your dad left you?
No, I don't know. It doesn't feel like a gift. A gift is something you choose to give someone. Like what a twisted gift that would be, right? Like, that's not what I wanted from him. You know, I wanted him to be around. I wanted him to be at my wedding, you know, or like meet my kids someday if I have kids. Like, so it doesn't feel like a gift. It feels like a weird consolation prize.
So Dean knows there won't be some magic moment when he feels better about everything and just sees the inheritance as money. But things are changing.
It's getting a little easier. Like, I can feel it. And I think when the money doesn't hold that much weight or like emotional charge, it's probably a sign that I've come to terms with things.
So, 2 years after his dad's death, he's moving in the right direction, and there's no need to rush. I'm Peter Balanon-Rosen for Marketplace.
Do me a favor, check out This Is Uncomfortable. It's a good one. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the caveat that A, you should always consult your own financial advisor, and B, you should not check your 401k statement on a daily basis. Anyway, Fidelity, the big investment firm, also an underwriter of this program, said today there is now a record number of Americans with 401ks worth at least $1 million, 196,000 accounts to be precise. Also, the number of IRAs, separate individual retirement accounts, worth seven figures, is also at a record. Two things about that. Number one, yes, to some degree, stock market gains, but also Fidelity says it's just that more people are putting more money aside for retirement, which is a good thing. All right, we're out. The Dow up 240 points today, 0.9%. NASDAQ also up 0.9%, 71 points there. S&P 500 up 23. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.